Well, the way our thoughts and prayers goes out to a lot of you in Hawaii, where these just all kinds of things have been happening, dams breaking, and there's another possibility of a second one busting loose. So hope all is well out there in Hawaii. We will be back in a moment with our guest Nick Redfern as we talk more about On the Trail of Saucer Spies right here on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, it must have been around 1980 when I talked to Leonard Stringfield. He then, of course, died later on. But he was one of the foremost investigators of crashed UFOs in the country, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. I mean, excuse me. Stringfield wrote seven status reports on his research into crashed UFOs, which anyone interested in crashed UFOs, you know, they're vital reading. They contain numerous accounts of reports and cases, and his interviews with people who, you know, related their own stories and first-hand experiences. And he also wrote two books, the most famous probably Situation Red, which was published in 77. He attracted a lot of official interest, and for example, we know from his own writings that he suspected this was going on. But again, I managed to get hold of at least several pages from his FBI file, one of which is significant because it talks about how the FBI recorded in the early 1950s that Stringfield suspected that the Air Force was tapping his home telephone. Now, you know, again, it's kind of ironic, as I said, that there's all this talk today about outrage at wiretaps and so forth. But half a century ago, the FBI were recording in their files that Stringfield himself back then was talking about wiretaps on.
I think he lived in Ohio, right, in Cincinnati?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he didn't actually live too far from, well, as the crow flies, from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So, you know, that was one of his prime areas of interest. But Stringfield, you know, as I said, put together a lot of good research and reports and a lot of leads for, you know, other people to follow up on. And Bill Moore, who co-wrote the first book on Roswell, said that his contacts in the intelligence world had told him that Stringfield was being watched. And now, you know, with some of these files, we can confirm that that was correct. And it actually went back to the early to mid 1950s. And, you know, again, a lot of these early crashed UFO researchers were also watched. I mean, if you look at, for example, Roswell, Bill Moore, who co-wrote the first book, The Roswell Incident, with Charles Berlitz, mm-hmm. his FBI file, we've been able to determine in the early 90s, was running at almost 70 pages in length. There's a file on Stanton Friedman, which is of undetermined length and undetermined classification. So, you know, it begs the question, how many more Roswell researchers are also the subject of official files? One of the things we know for certain, and which we're also able to determine the length of the files, relates to the slightly lesser known, but certainly quite well-known case at Aztec, New Mexico in 1948. I guess for many people with an interest in crashed UFOs, the Aztec story is kind of like the little brother of Roswell, if you like. And it's, you know, kind of similar to Roswell in the sense the story was that early 1948, a UFO crashed at near the town of Aztec, New Mexico, and a number of small bodies were found on board, and the device and the bodies were whisked away by the military to a secret location for research and analysis. Well, the story primarily surfaced from two people, one named Silas Newton and another named Leo Jabawa, who had quite controversial backgrounds, but whereas practically all, if not all, of the documentation relating to Roswell just, you know, cannot be found. We don't have any of the original official files. Quite the opposite's the case with Aztec. And the FBI have a huge file on Leo Jabawa, which runs to 400 pages in length.
That's huge.
That's huge, of which less than 50% has been declassified. And even though some people, you know, dispute the Aztec crash story, what's interesting is that a number of the pages within the Jabawa file are classified in the interest of, or B1, which is the a section of the Freedom of Information Act, which covers national security and defense of the United States. So, you know, if there was absolutely nothing to this story and it was all just garbage, why is one of the key players in the story subject to an FBI file, which in part is classified for national defense reasons? And what the file shows is that the FBI, in the very, very early years of when the Aztec story surfaced in 1950, was fully aware of who was talking to who was publishing what. And there's a whole section in one of the FBI surveillance files on Jaber and Silas Newton, which relates the entire Aztec story about the crash, about the recovery of the bodies, about who Newton was speaking to, who Jaber was speaking to, about how Frank Scully, who wrote the first book on crash sources called Behind the Flying Saucers, which talks about how Scully was publishing the story, where he was publishing it, what the reaction was, public lectures that Silas Newton mm-hmm. was giving. So, you know, it's kind of like a scenario where, you know, if, say, for example, I come on your show tonight, and then somebody prepares this huge report and says, well, George Norris is telling so-and-so, Nick Redfern speaking to somebody else. That's the analogy. And it's a very, very extensive section within the file showing that the FBI had full tabs on who was speaking to who about this crash case. And, of course, you know, that could well apply to other crash reports. And, it becomes easy to understand why some of these incidents are easy to cover up, because from the word go, practically, the military and the intelligence community, as we can now demonstrate from these files, have been able to keep tabs on the researchers and the key players in the story from the very beginning. And, again, the Aztec files are officially declassified files, and I've presented the extensive and the more important quotes concerning Aztec and the surveillance of the players in the story in the book. But, I mean, there are other examples, too, as I said, not just Aztec and Bill Moore and Friedman, but there's an interesting case and kind of a weird case that occurred in the early 1950s when in the United States, actually in New Mexico, where a guy had come across some strange fragments of metal on the ground, which I didn't know what they were, but, you know, they were strange, put it that way. There was something unusual about them, and this guy didn't know what they were, but he contacted the Air Force because he said he'd actually been visited by a representative of the Russian embassy who was interested in getting hold of these fragments. And a report was put together on this case, and, you know, it was never really resolved. But, it, you know, again, it shows that when people talk about crashed UFO incidents and then they're warned off or visited by the military, there actually is precedence for this recorded at an official level. And interestingly enough, I mentioned Frank Edwards' Flying Saucers Serious Business book. In the FBI's book review, if you like, of his book, he actually talks about a number of crashed UFO cases in that book. And a summary of those crash reports occurs is featured in the FBI review. So it wasn't just the military, it was the FBI as well, also, you know, looking into these reports about crashed UFOs and, again, who was speaking to who and on what subject.
I think it was his book, Nick, that had a case that I'll always remember, and it had to do with a UFO craft. The occupants could be seen from a ministry and a priest who was testifying about this, and I think it might have been in New Guinea. But I think the case was in Edwards' book, but I'll always remember that because I was a kid when I read that book. And the way he described it, that the craft came by, the occupants like waved at each other, you know, down with the priest yeah. and the people. And it was just a strange story. It doesn't have anything to do with some of the stuff you're investigating, but it attests to the work that Edwards did back in an era that nobody was really doing this.
Well, that's right. You know, I think in some respects, as I said, although some people considered Frank Edwards to be, you know, kind of like a tabloid writer, there's no doubt that, you know, he did bring the subject to the attention of a lot of people. And as you said, a lot of us, I mean, you know, I actually got interested in the subject as a, you know, at a young age, sort of early teenage, maybe even before that. And, you know, I read all those early books, like the Frank Edwards books and the Hynek books and things like that. And I think, you know, they serve as a good taster for what was to come later on. And, you know, we have to remember a lot of these early guys, they didn't have access to things like the internet, you know, or anything like that.
That's
at
right.
all. They were, you know, they were having to go out and make phone calls on at their own expense and drive across the country to interview people. And, you know, okay, some of the cases, maybe they didn't get all the facts right or they couldn't investigate the cases fully. But, you know, they were doing the best they could in that period. And I think we need to applaud them for bringing the material forward to the extent that they were able to.
Well, what I found amazing, too, is several of the people of those early years were basically hired by the government to debunk and investigate the UFO phenomena. You know, that being Dr. J. Allen Hynek and also Edward Ruppelt. Both of them eventually went on to believe that extraterrestrials and flying saucers were real.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the interesting things is that, as you say, people like Hynek in particular, he's probably the classic best example of someone who, you know, on the government payroll, if you like, or at a contract level, saying, you know, there's nothing to this and we can resolve these cases. And then he becomes a literal champion of the subject. And, you know, I can only conclude that it's the wealth of good material that makes them change their opinions. And, of course, you know, this, I think we have to come to some conclusion, or part of the conclusion at least, is based on the fact that there are good cases in government files, and some I'm sure that we haven't even seen, that makes these people suddenly switch their opinions from skeptic to believer, or more interestingly, or more perhaps relevant, maybe it's not so much they're changing their opinions, it's after they've retired, they're more amenable to speaking out.
He was haunted. He was haunted, Nick, when he was covering the case in Michigan, and he called it swamp gas. And, I mean, I don't think he was ever able to live that down, because that just followed him. Even when he began to become a supporter of the UFOs investigations, that swamp gas thing always kept coming up.
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, that, you know, to say something like that, it's something that he's going to stick with you, and it did. And as you say, even though he became a champion of the subject, Hynek, and, you know, founded the Center for UFO Studies, which, you know, the spin-off was the International UFO Reporter magazine, a sort of very scholarly, good magazine. But you're quite right that there was always that kind of swamp gas thing lurking in the background, and his Air Force background and so on. But, you know, I don't think that dismisses or takes away from the fact that he did tremendously, you know, boost the profile of the UFO
absolutely.
Subject as well.
Absolutely. Was there ever anything in the files about NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, one of the first organizations to investigate UFOs?
There really is. And there's one very good case which I've related in the book. I mean, a lot of your listeners might know the fact that a lot of allegations have been made about NICAP having been infiltrated by elements of the CIA, which, again, you know, is another part of the story about infiltration.
And it was based in Washington, D.C., right?
That's
if I remember.
Yeah. And they, you know, they were a very, very powerful group. It may be, you know, hard for people today to recognize how significant they were, you know, getting congressmen and senators interested and, you know, briefing people and things like that. And previously, you know, there's been a lot of coverage of the way in which the CIA monitored the NICAP organization and infiltrated it, and to the point where it actually diffused, you know, the power of the organization. And because a lot of that's been discussed very, very extensively in previous books, although I touch on it, I didn't want to kind of, you know, just keep going over old ground for people. So I actually began looking into other areas of what NICAP was doing, and found an FBI file which talks about how the FBI were monitoring a story concerning a source working at NASA who supposedly had access to classified photographs of UFOs actually taken by astronauts and related to other photographs connected with the space program. And there was the story was that this particular source was making this material available to NICAP. And this is mentioned in all the official files about how the source even put hairs on the back of the envelopes and stuck them down so he could tell, you know, he could tell if the letters had been tampered with or opened before they reached their destination, which is, you know, suggests a degree of sophistication. But more importantly, it also suggests that the source was legitimate in terms of having highly classified and sensitive materials. But the FBI prepared a report on this, and the report itself is quite heavily censored, but it does talk about how they knew this source at NASA had access to this materials and was sharing it with people in NICAP. And bear in mind, this investigation involved NASA and the FBI. You can well understand why NICAP would be subject to some sort of official surveillance. But again, this is an officially declassified file as well.
Whatever happened to that British hacker who broke into the American government's computers because he wanted to check out UFOs?
Matthew Bevin. I've actually got a complete chapter on the book on Bevin. Matthew Bevin was a young, well, he's still young now. He's only about 30 now. But when he was about 17 years old, which would be about 1994, he began to get interested in UFOs. And he lives in Cardiff, Wales. And began getting interested in things like Roswell, Area 51, the legends about things like Hangar 18 and terminology like that. And obviously began doing searches and for information and, you know, found the central thread to a lot of this was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is one of these places that's, for many, many years, you know, it's been rumored it's like a holding place for crashed UFO technology and alien bodies in cryogenic storage and deep underground. And although there actually isn't a Hangar 18 as such, that's become kind of like a generic term for what this location may be. Well, Bevin, Matthew Bevin, instead of, I guess, you know, just researching on the internet or reading books and magazines, he kind of decided to take a fairly unconventional approach and actually hacked into the computer systems at Wright-Patterson. What happened was he did this in 94, 95, and he hacked Wright-Patterson. He hacked the Rome laboratories at Griffiths Air Force Base, which is involved in defense issues. He hacked Lockheed, NASA, all sorts of organizations. Now, of course, I don't, you know, endorse him doing that, but this is just what he did. And in 1996, he was arrested while working in Cardiff by two representatives of Scotland Yard's Computer Crime Unit, one named Simon James, and And what happened was that he was arrested and interviewed and questioned vigorously about what he'd seen on the Wright-Patterson computers by Scotland Yard. And it appears to be the case that the American military had been watching him for some time to try and determine who he was and what he was doing, and really to try and follow the path of what he was up to, not arrest him straight away, but to see what was...
Just to watch him.
Yeah. And what happened was that the Scotland Yard had quite obviously been briefed on some of the systems that Bevin had got into, because they asked him several to go over several key things time and time again. One of the things they asked him was what the term Hangar 18 meant to him, and he said, well, you know, it's supposedly a hoarding place for UFO... crashed UFO technology. And one of the other areas that Bevin had got into, had hacked into at Wright-Patterson, and again, what I'm telling you now is actually public record, because there was a court case and some of the files have now been declassified through the Freedom of Information Act. So it's not, this aspect of the story isn't, you know, classified. It's now declassified. But Bevin said that he read online, didn't download or print, he said. He read online a number of files showing that at Wright-Patterson, one particular office was heavily involved in researching, in simplistic terms, what we would call anti-gravity type technology. Now, what was most peculiar, I guess, was that the description of the device that Bevin was talking about seeing was very, very similar to the description of some of the objects that Bob Lazar described, like a split-level type vehicle that was powered by a super heavy element. This was actually discussed in the files that Bevin read. Now, Scotland Yard said to him, did you read these files? He said, yes. And they said, did you download it? And they said, he said, no. Are you sure you didn't download anything? Yes. So you didn't download anything. And just going over and over. but he was, as I said, arrested and brought to court. He actually went to court. And that's how we know all this went on, because some of the files are now being made available.
He's still a Brit, isn't he?
Oh yeah, he lives in Wales. I mean, he ran a computer company afterwards called Tiger Security, where you could hire him too.
I bet he's an expert. Hey, Nick, let's take this break. We'll come back. We'll also talk about Project Serpo in just a moment. Well, anything new on underground bases? We'll check in with Nick on that. And also this Project Serpo case that just continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, what did you uncover on underground bases? Anything?
Yeah, a few things, George. I think previously on the show, one of the people you've had on is Greg Bishop, who
yes.
wrote the book Project Beta, about which in part touches on the story and the allegations about an underground base at Dulce, New Mexico. Well, one of the areas that I looked into was the issue of cattle mutilations. And what I found was that the FBI in the late 70s had dug quite extensively into the cattle mutilation issue and had numerous files and reports on record from the Dulce area, precisely where this underground base was rumored to be. And this actually tied in as well with the FBI monitoring lectures and conferences and newspaper and magazine reports on animal mutilations in that particular area. And so what I found, in part at least, was that there was FBI interest in cattle mutilations. There was specific FBI interest in the Dulce area with regard to these weird events. And also the fact that Greg himself was subjected to some sort of surveillance to where letters and phone calls, for example, were either interfered with or monitored in various ways when he was talking to certain cattle mutilation researchers, and also when he was in correspondence with the late Carla Turner, UFO abductee and researcher and author. And so collectively the picture that came together was one of tremendous interest in the Dulce area, and also of keen interest in key players in the underground base arena, like Greg Bishop. Now, admittedly, you know, aspects of this story are kind of fragmentary, but nevertheless, you know, this does point to the fact that some of the key underground base researchers have been watched, specifically because also of this Dulce angle as well. And there's kind of a similar story in England as well about a place called RAF Rudlow Manor, which is built upon a huge area of quarried out tunnels and caverns. And beneath RAF Rudlow Manor, there's this huge underground installation which can be used in the event of a national emergency by, unfortunately, the higher up people within the government and family.
They've already got their escape route, right?
Well, the general public are left to fend for themselves. But a friend of mine in England, a researcher named Matthew Williams, dug extensively into the subject of what was going on deep below RAF Rudlow Manor, because there were similar stories to Wright-Patterson with alien bodies supposedly held in cryogenic storage beneath Rudlow, kind of a similar scenario. And Matthew Williams dug deep into this whole area, and he himself became the subject of an investigation by a department of the British Police Force called Special Branch, who wanted to know why he was spending so much time investigating this base and tracking down people who used to work there and, you know, trying to open up what was going on at a UFO level. So this is, I guess, two prime examples from other sides of the world of people in the UFO subject, like Greg and Matthew, being watched in part, at least, because of their cattle mutilation and underground base links, which in some way were actually connected with each other. But again, as I said, this is one of those areas of the UFO subject that I sort of hit partly at least a brick wall, and you know, you're forced to put some of the pieces together yourself from deduction and common sense. But it's quite clear, you know, that these people who were players in the subject were being watched. I mean, another one, Gabe Valdez, who was attached to the New Mexico State Police in the 1970s, he collated a huge number of cattle mutilation reports, all of which found themselves were forwarded to the FBI, and Gabe Valdez was interviewed extensively by Greg Bishop for his Project Beta book. Mm-hmm. So again, you have all the central players interlinked in this story with the Dulce area, and Dulce was where Guy Valdez worked as well. So, you know, there's a tremendous story here still to be uncovered if we can put all the threads together.
Speaking of tremendous stories, have you been following this Project Serpo story?
Yes, I have. The allegations about a team from the military being
transferred,
like to an exchange type visit almost to this mm-hmm. planet. I followed it very extensively, and I'm on a couple of the mailing lists, you know, that send out new information and discussion and things like that. I don't for 1 minute think it's a straightforward hoax. I think there are two possibilities. Either it's literally real or it's disinformation. Now, where the truth lies, I think at this stage, you know, it's incredibly difficult to say. Obviously, looking at the documents, you know, a tremendous amount of work has gone into their production. And
right.
I guess they are today what the MJ-12 documents were 15, 20 years ago or 10 years ago. You know,
well, if it was disinformation, do you think it would be an official kind of disinformation project, or is it just a group of people having a good time?
No, I actually don't think it's. I don't think it's, you know, a bunch of guys with computers or whatever, or, you know, old typewriters and things like this, just having a laugh at the UFO research community's expense.
Okay.
I think it is either literally real or it has to be some sort of official disinformation project. One of the things that I've wondered is if it isn't so much a case of putting out disinformation, I do sometimes wonder if it's an easy way of seeing who in the UFO subject speaking to who, who's in touch with who, you know, and how the story's being spread and things like that, and watching the community to see, you know, what we do with the story, whether we run with it and so forth, or we dig into it and we find that, yes, it seems real, or no, it seems problematic. But, you know, there's no doubt that if you read those documents, a huge amount of work's gone into the production in terms of, you know, trying to present a credible story that, for all intents and purposes, seems to hang together. You know, it isn't something somebody's just cobbled together, you know, in a few
sure.
hours.
And it's not for profit. It's not as if they're out making money on it.
Well, that's one of the things that I always look into, you know, when we have these stories. What's the motivation for the story? And, you know, if somebody comes out with a story and or something along these lines, and, you know, they're quite obviously just like a showman or, you know, a P.T. Barnum type character,
right.
then you can gauge something from that, and it's usually the correct scenario.
Assumption,
but,
sure.
Yeah, it's correct assumption. But I think with these documents, that's the baffling thing. They've just surfaced, and there doesn't really seem, and they're being given away freely and openly, and there doesn't seem to be the hoax motivation there that we would see if it was just, you know, somebody spinning a tall tale. So that's why, regardless of what they are, I'm convinced they come from within the intelligence world. You know, and I think we have to bear in mind also, it's literally only been, I think, since November, since they surfaced.
Sure.
So we're only sort of 4 months into the investigation. You know, things like MJ-12 are still being discussed. I think it was 1987 when, you know, Friedman and Moore released the first MJ-12 documents publicly. That's 19 years ago. So, it's very, very early days. But I think the fact that in the internet era, with so much discussion today, we're going to get answers pretty quickly rather than, you know, have to wait a long time. And I think
Could you accept, though, Nick, the theory of an exchange program between us and extraterrestrials? I mean, is that possible?
I think it is possible. I think one of the things that interest me about those documents is that, you know, that they do seem to sort of portray a picture of what does sound like a very, very alien-sounding world. You know, it's almost like not a nightmarish scenario, but almost, you know, how you might react if you were on another world. You know, the people were talking about feeling nauseous and kind of disorientated mm-hmm. and, you know, that they were in some sort of totally alien environment for which they weren't really equipped to deal with, and there were deaths and, you know, they were feeling ill all the time and, you know, the landscape looked different and, you know, a completely different culture and environment. And that, in some ways, that does sort of ring true as to how a person might react, you know, it's, if you were thrust into a completely different world, so to speak.
So if a movie pops up in Hollywood called Project Serpo, then we might be able to surmise what this was all about.
Well, you know, I mean, when you talk about movies, I mean, the scenario is actually not unlike the sort of the final moments of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when you had a human team go up with the aliens into the spacecraft.
Right.
And, I mean, I know from on the discussion list that a number of people on those lists previously employed in the military and in the intelligence community have said that they saw those documents at a previous point, that, or they'd seen the scenario and the story related in other documents, you know, years ago in the 70s and the 80s. So even if the Serpo documents in the current format, if you like, have only just surfaced, the broad scenario of some sort of exchange program allegedly going on was apparently mentioned, you know, in previous years, and primarily, I think, within higher echelons of the Defense Intelligence Agency particularly. There seem to have been people there that knew aspects of this story, again, back in the 80s.
It really is a very incredible story.
Oh, it is.
Any, do you want to take a stab at who Anonymous might be?
Well, you know, I have no idea who Anonymous is, truthfully, but you know, one of the agencies that does keep cropping up time and time again in the story is the Defense Intelligence Agency, and people having made comments. I've had a number of off-list emails sent to me about, you know, the DIA seemed to know more about this, or certain people in there did. So I would gauge that maybe that's where we would need to look, is that maybe somebody within the DIA specifically had access to this material, has access to it. And you know, I actually wonder if it is kind of a controlled release, you know, being done officially, to see how acclimatized we can become to this material.
I was going to say that. Could this be a prelude to disclosure?
It could be. And the one reason why I say that is because, you know, if it was, say, one or two pages, you could imagine somebody, you know, I guess, potentially smuggling that out. But dozens or hundreds of pages of material, that would be, I think, and if it was highly classified material, as this seems to be, it would be incredibly difficult for someone to get that past security, which does make me wonder if this, for whatever purpose, is a controlled release of information, you know, to make it easy for somebody to get access to it. You know, again, for what purpose, I don't know, but I think, you know, the official hand does have is the central role, if you like, in terms of getting this material out there.
Well, based on what I've read so far with this, Nick, I can't shoot any holes through it yet. How about you?
No, I mean, that is one of the things, as I said, that is interesting about this material, is that a huge amount of work's gone into it in terms of ensuring that it comes across like a solid, carefully put together, not so much carefully put together story, but that it actually does seem to ring true. You know, that the person obviously knows a lot about the UFO subject, and the story, you know, reads like fact. And I think for that reason, that's why it's got people's interest so much. You know, it's not like a fragmentary one-page document that could be anything. It's a huge task, a huge piece of work. And I think it's that that impresses me in terms of us, you know, needing to look into it and see what develops and where it all goes. And I think, you know, it'll become one of the big talking points over the next 12 months, I'm sure.
Now, is it grown, or who's posting on this now? Is it still anonymous and then other people join in?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, it's anonymous. And then, you know, you have some people who've come forward and said, well, you know, I was in the military and I saw something like this back in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s that, although I don't remember the name Project Serpo, I do remember seeing something about an exchange program. There have been several people who've come forward like that. Some people who've said that they saw documentation that kind of followed the scenario. For example, Anonymous talks about aspects of the Roswell story. A number of people have said that they saw documents that confirmed the Roswell angle that Anonymous is talking about, some of the little known aspects of that story. So we've got people like that coming forward and, you know, adding their materials. There are people looking at, into some of the scientific aspects of the terminology, and you're trying to determine if the type of terminology used in the documents existed in the 60s and 70s, you know, sort of the phraseology that's around today, was it around back then? You know, a kind of a forensic analysis of the wording. Also, for example, one of the documents that surfaced recently concerned the Kingman crash at Arizona in 1953. And there are references in there to, you know, aspects of the story that aren't necessarily widely known at an open level. For example, references to people supposedly going on board the Kingman craft and becoming very, very ill, taken ill after going in inside this vehicle. And that's surfaced in a number of other reports, and one or two people have been focusing on that, you know, looking at the issue of drive systems and whether it could affect,
sure,
you know, the human body and so on.
In anything you came across in terms of documents, anything on Travis Walton, the person who was abducted, or the late Colonel Philip Corso, did you find anything on them?
No, I mean, as far as Travis Walton's concerned, no, I didn't find anything. Although I will say that, as I said, I have a whole chapter in the book on surveillance of abductees. Now, as I mentioned near the beginning of the interview, I found several reports where, for example, young women had been interviewed by the military after they'd had late-night UFO encounters, some of it which were vehicle interference cases, some where these things have been seen hovering outside their bedroom windows, which, you know, kind of sounds like someone's fishing for information on abduction-type stories. Several other reports, as I mentioned, were, for example, Greg Bishop, all his correspondence pretty much with Dr. Carla Turner, who's now deceased, an abduction researcher and author, pretty much all their correspondence was opened when Greg received it by somebody prior to him
somebody
receiving
else,
it.
Somebody else,
yeah. And I've also recounted in the book several cases, one from a woman actually living, in Texas today. And she had an experience in 1973 where she'd seen a UFO and had a typical period of missing time. Obviously, abductions weren't that well known at the time. And she was visited by a couple of guys in the immediate aftermath from Kirtland Air Force Base who apparently knew about the abduction and didn't threaten her, but actually were very interested and concerned about what abductions were, and asked her a lot of questions if she could help them and, you know, try and determine what these aliens were, where they were from, what they wanted. And you know, she said they were actually quite friendly and said, you know, we don't want to alarm people. We're just quietly asking people who know something about this, can they help us? And she sat down with them for a period of time and related her accounts, and they took details and said thank you very much and went on their way. And there are several cases I've got like that in the book that link intelligence personnel at Kirtland Air Force Base on some sort of small but official project that was involved and centered around monitoring abductees to try and determine what was going on. And that, you know, that doesn't surprise me, and that seems to be a thread, is that abductees were being watched because the military knew something was going on, but they weren't entirely sure what it was or why it was going on. And, you know, I think they figured the best people to go to were the abductees. But I think today that would fall down because it would become public so quickly. You know, people would run to the UFO magazines or whatever. But back in the early 70s, when it was not that well known, I think that afforded them better cover, if you like, to visit these people quietly and, you know, not have the story come blown wide open.
We'll be back in a moment. We'll take phone calls with our guest, Nick Redfern, and talking about UFO magazines. Nick will be the lead story in UFO magazine upcoming this month. So look for your UFO magazine on your favorite newsstands. You'll see the big story on Nick Redfern. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.